Then, as we continue to look at the night before Calvary, is John 13, verses 12 to 20. And Jesus has just washed his disciples' feet. And we've really emphasized in the last two sermons the deeper significance of that act, the way in which it pictures something else. It pictures the greater washing Jesus is soon going to achieve, the washing away of sins through his death on the cross. And we've emphasized that because John, and indeed Jesus, emphasized that in those first 11 verses of the chapter. But as we move now into these next few verses, there's a shift. Jesus' washing of his disciples' feet continues to be in view, but no longer now as a symbolic thing, no longer as a picture of something else. Now it's considered just at a very basic and literal level. Notice how in verse 12, Jesus has finished the foot washing and returned to the table, and he asks the question, "Do you understand what I have done to you?" Well, he knows that they don't understand it at the deeper level. He knows they don't understand it as a preview of what's going to happen the next day, his death on the cross. He has just said to Peter, hasn't he, in verse 7, "What I am doing now, you do not understand, but afterward you will understand." But you see, here in verse 12, he's not talking about that anymore. He's not talking now about the deeper significance. Now he's talking about a much more obvious and straightforward significance that the foot washing has, a significance which all these men in the room should easily be able to understand, namely this: Jesus has just served them. He has been, over these last few minutes, their servant. He has, in a major way, put their interests and their comfort above his own. That's the significance of the foot washing now in this new section of John 13. All the subtleties connected to the foot washing, all the nuances and hints and foreshadowings that have been there in the previous verses, and we've tried to tease them out, they all recede now, they all drop away. And Jesus scrubbing between these men's toes now is just quite simply an act of lowly, humble, self-abasing, others-prioritizing service. That's what's in view here. And here's my question then. What should we make of the foot washing just at that level? What should we make of Jesus behaving like that? What should we make of him doing what servants do? What should we make of him relating to the others in the room in such a radically servile manner? Well, I want to flag up two contrasting approaches that we can take to it. Two alternative ways we can view this act of service by Jesus. And I do stress those words, contrasting and alternative. The two perspectives that we're going to consider, they are mutually exclusive. They are incompatible with each other. They can't both be adopted. Rather, we must choose between them. And so here goes. How should we view this act of service? Number one, we can see it as lessening the dignity of Jesus. That's one option. That's one possibility. We can see it as lessening the dignity of Jesus. In the summer of 2001, I went one midweek evening to Haughtonley Spring between Sunderland and Durham. I went there to hear the great John Stott preach. Mike Johnson, I think, was perhaps also there that night, although I didn't know him then. And at this service then, at some point prior to John Stott preaching, the chairperson took the opportunity to congratulate Peter Vardy. Peter Vardy was at that time in charge of Reg Vardy, one of the largest car dealerships in the country. He's a Christian. He belonged to that church in Haughtonley Spring. And that week, in the summer of 2001, he had been knighted. He was now Sir Peter Vardy. And so, as I say, the chairperson that night, he wanted to acknowledge that, and he asked Peter Vardy then to come up to the front while everyone would applaud him. And as that was happening, as he asked Peter Vardy to come to the front, I saw the pianist, a rather scruffily dressed fellow, get up from the piano. What's he up to? I thought to myself. He must want to get a better view of Sir Peter Vardy coming to the front. But to my great surprise, the scruffily dressed pianist didn't perch himself in some new spot where the sight lines were a bit clearer. Rather, he made his way right up to the centre of the stage, shook the hand of the chairperson, and then smiled broadly as the congregation clapped. It wasn't that this guy wanted to get a better view of Sir Peter Vardy. No, I suddenly realised this guy actually was Sir Peter Vardy. But you see then how my young, foolish thought processes worked. I expected this newly appointed knight to be sitting in his own special place in the room, surrounded by his team and looking ever so eminent and distinguished. Whereas, as far as I was concerned, a guy who dons a pair of baggy trousers and mucks in with playing the piano, he can't be anyone great. He can't be anyone important. He can't be one of Europe's leading businessmen with a personal fortune of £170 million. He can't have featured in the Queen's birthday honours list. And we can look at Jesus then, in the upper room, with my summer of 2001 mindset. I mean, forget baggy trousers. Jesus, for a few minutes here, is in his underwear. Forget mucking in with playing the piano. Jesus is literally removing muck from his disciples' feet. And we can look at all of that then, and we can say, well, he can't be anyone great. He can't be anyone important. What's the hymn writer on about? Jesus shall take the highest honour. He's just a little foot washer, for goodness sake. A performer of menial tasks. I mean, Donald Trump, look at him now. He wears a suit. And he flies around the globe talking tough to world leaders and getting them to agree on things. Prince William, he runs the prestigious International Earthshot Prize aimed at solving huge environmental problems by the end of the decade. Taylor Swift, she announces something online and it virtually crashes the internet. That's the kind of stuff that really great people get up to. Jesus, on the other hand, what does he do? He messes about with a basin and a towel, ensuring that 12 pairs of feet are nice and clean. How limp and underwhelming and unimpressive is that? He can't be anyone great. Well, if we are inclined to look at this man on the floor in the upper room the way that I looked at the man at the piano in Hortonleigh Spring, if we are inclined to think little of the dignity and greatness of this one who washes feet, then verse 13 should be a thunderbolt to us. You call me teacher and Lord, Jesus says, and you are right, for so I am. That's quite a claim, especially that second title, Lord. I mean, Lord could be used in banal contexts in the first century, but it could also be a very big word. And the fact Jesus affirms in this way his own possession of the title indicates that he's thinking here in big terms. If he'd had in mind Lord here in its blander sense, he wouldn't need to be so emphatic, would he? You are right, so I am. It'd be like me saying in a very loud, dramatic voice, do you know what, everybody? Please understand this. I'm a Mr. Dan Peters. I actually am. You'd all go, well, yeah, of course. So what? What's the big deal? Why the grand announcement? And it would be like that with Jesus here if he's just using the word Lord in its mildest sense. No, he must be thinking here in big terms. I mean, this title, it was a title that was ascribed to Roman emperors. Indeed, more than that, for Greek-speaking Christians in the first century, this was a title that even had overtones of deity. In their Greek Old Testaments, Kurios, Lord, it was used to translate the divine name, Yahweh. I'm saying Jesus is claiming here at least to be a great king, wielding immense power and authority, and probably he's claiming actually to be Yahweh himself. And we need to be clear on this point then. The man in this room with the basin and the towel acting like a nobody, he's not a nobody. He's the emperor of the universe. The man tending diligently to Peter and John's grotty toes and looking like the lowest ranking person in all Jerusalem, he's not the lowest ranking person in all Jerusalem. He is Yahweh Almighty. The man stripped down to a loincloth and to all appearances devoid of nobility, he is not devoid of nobility. He is the God of heaven incarnate. Peter and John and Andrew, any of those men in that room, they could have said in those moments, they could have said, do you know what? God is washing my feet right now. And that would not have been blasphemous. And that would not have been profane. That would have been 100% accurate. As Jesus removed pieces of animal excrement from the skin of their feet, they could, in that very same moment, have worshipped him with the loftiest, sublimest doxologies, and it wouldn't have been remotely inappropriate and out of place for them to do so. He did not cease to be Lord as he crawled around on the floor amongst their legs. His deity wasn't suspended. It wasn't switched off. It wasn't turned down a little. He was God while he washed their feet just as much as he was God when he created every galaxy in this cosmos. He was God as he washed their feet no less than he was God when the prophet Isaiah saw him high and lifted up and surrounded by awestruck cherubim. We could add another verse to the admittedly already lengthy hymn that we sang a moment ago. Who is he takes off his clothes, washes Peter's stinking toes? 'Tis the Lord. 'Tis the Lord. It's the Lord doing that. Let's not look at this scene in the upper room and question Jesus' dignity and greatness and grandeur. Let's not say, oh, this one who's washing feet cannot be truly great. Let's rather look at it and say, wow, this one who is truly great washes feet. That's the point. So I'm saying then, here's one angle from which we can approach this act of service, and I hope that none of you will approach it from this angle. We can see it as lessening the dignity of Jesus. But then the alternative, secondly, is this. We can see it instead as heightening the dignity of service. Instead of seeing it as lessening the dignity of Jesus, we can see it as heightening the dignity of service. This is the other possibility. And this then is how we ought to see it. Verses 14 and 15. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. What takes place in this upper room here is not belittling Jesus, it's rather bigging up service. It's saying service is a lordly activity. Service is a kingly activity. Service is what great ones do, what the greatest one of all does, and service, therefore, is the way to go. And look with me at verse 16. Where he continues, truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. And of course, Jesus isn't just stating a general principle there. I mean, in and of itself, it's really too obvious to need saying, isn't it? Everybody knows what he says there in verse 16, if you just kind of take that as a general principle. But he's saying it, of course, in connection with the foot washing. And he's saying then, if I, possessing a higher status by far than you men, if I engage in this lowly conduct, there can be no grounds whatsoever for you to opt out of doing so. And the really important bit of the verse is the second half of it. Because the idea of these men being sent, which is what Jesus alludes to there in the second half of verse 16, the idea of these men being sent by Christ, if you've read John's Gospel, you'll know that that is a central motif of this fourth gospel. Again and again we encounter it. They are being sent out, these men, sent out by Christ into the world. Sent out to do what? Well, of course, to take everywhere the message of his saving work. But here, fascinatingly, Jesus is adding a further dimension to that sending out. Here, he's saying that the manner in which they go as they're sent out, the manner in which they undertake their mission, that's actually just as important as the message. He's saying they mustn't only be bearers of the gospel as they go out. No, they must be foot-washing bearers of the gospel. They must be servant-hearted bearers of the gospel. That's how the one sending them conducts himself. They must conduct themselves in the same way as the ones being sent. They mustn't be belligerent and combative as they go out. They mustn't seek to win the world through the power of the sword or by gaining places of influence at society's top table. They mustn't be full of swagger and bluster and aggression. No, they must be full of meekness, gentle souls who don't insist on their rights but humbly seek the good of others. That's how they are to go in this great sending out that's so integral to John's gospel. Certainly they are to go with the right message, with the true, undiluted message of a crucified and risen Saviour, but they are also to go in the right manner, replicating the servant-heartedness of the one who is sending them out. And even for us today, this probably sounds a wee bit countercultural. Surely lowly service is no serious strategy for missionary success. Conquer the world by washing feet? How feeble! What a recipe for failure! And if it sounds countercultural today, we can be sure it sounded 10 times more so in that first century context. I mean, imagine a Roman emperor in the first century proposing to the Senate, look, chaps, we're going to shift the emphasis away from military might. We've been doing military might for centuries now. That's a tired policy. We need to freshen things up. Instead of ploughing all our resources into producing soldiers, we're going to produce from now on squadrons of servants. Doesn't matter whether or not they can wield a spear, that's no longer important. They must know how to prioritize others above themselves. Those are the skills that we're going to concentrate on from now on. I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it? No self-respecting Roman emperor that didn't want a knife to be put in his back would ever think, ever dream of proposing a policy like that. The first century world was obsessed with strength and force and dominion. There was no other model for success. And you can imagine then these men here in this room thinking, hang on, Jesus, hang on a minute. You're saying here that the sent ones should be just like the sender. You're saying that what we've just seen happen in these last few minutes in this room, that's to be replicated as we now go out into the world with the gospel. Are you sure about that, Jesus? Jesus, don't you understand? We are 12 men here taking on the world. The odds are already stacked absolutely against us. And now we're being told that we're in fact 12 men taking on the world armed with basins and towels. Great, Jesus. Great. Other movements that are out there, they rampage, they storm, they overwhelm. What are we going to do? We're going to wash people's feet. We might as well just write the obituary of the Christian church right now, Jesus. I'm saying Jesus is being countercultural here, to the point that the disciples are probably questioning his sanity. But having established that, we need to notice, as we close this evening, 3 quick points in verses 17 to 20. And first of all, in Jesus' statement there in verse 17, where he continues, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Now, whenever I've preached on the first few verses of Matthew 5, the first few verses of the Sermon on the Mount, and that series of statements, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, and so on. I've suggested this alternative way of reading those. In a great situation are the poor in spirit. In a great situation are those who mourn. In a great situation are the meek. That's what I think Jesus means. In each case, you see, the trait or behavior that he's mentioning, poverty of spirit, mourning, meekness, etc., in each case, it seems terribly disadvantageous. It seems to make you a bit of a loser. According to this world's values, it does. But Jesus is insisting that actually the opposite is the case. He's insisting that his poor in spirit, mourning, meek disciples, they are in fact in a great situation. Doesn't seem it from the world's perspective. They seem like stupid losers practicing those kinds of characteristics. But no, Jesus said, actually, they're in a great situation. And I think verse 17 here in our passage works in the same way. And Jesus has just been saying then, as we've just been saying, this idea of spreading the gospel in a posture of humble service, it seems terribly disadvantageous. It seems like it's going to get absolutely nowhere in that first century world. It seems like it spells the end of all hopes of success. If these men are going to go out into the world washing people's feet and thinking nothing of their own status, then they are destined for failure. They're doomed. That's how it appears. And Jesus here, you see, in verse 17, he's tackling that head on. And he's saying, no. It's not like that at all. The opposite's the case. If you men go out committed to a lifestyle of lowly service, you're not doomed. The church isn't doomed. My cause in this world isn't doomed. No, you're not doomed. Actually, you're blessed. You're in a great situation. It's not a recipe for failure. Going out and being foot washers and taking the gospel to the ends of the earth as lowly, menial, humble servants, that is not a recipe for failure. In actual fact, it's a recipe for success. In that way, you will conquer the world by refusing to be loud and overbearing and self-promoting and all the things that in this world's eyes get you somewhere. And by choosing instead the route of unostentatious kindness and helpfulness and servant-heartedness, you will find that your mission makes terrific headway in this world. That's what Jesus means, I think, when he says, blessed are you if you go out in this way. And cannot you and I say this evening that subsequent history has vindicated Jesus' words? Glasgow University, there's a museum, and last Saturday, Isaac and Fraser and I had a look round the museum in Glasgow University, and one of the displays was all about the Antonine Wall. The Antonine Wall was a Roman wall which went from the Clyde in the west to the Firth of Forth in the east, and for a short time then it was the northern frontier of the Roman Empire. It was only the northern frontier for a short time because the southern Scottish tribes proved too much of a handful for the Roman soldiers who were defending the wall, and so they soon retreated to Hadrian's Wall and made that the northern frontier instead. But the display then about the Antonine Wall was very interesting, featuring stones from the wall and various artifacts. But what I found even more interesting was this thought. When that Antonine Wall was being built in the middle of the 2nd century AD, the Roman Empire was vast and bold and defiant. The Christian Church, on the other hand, was an irrelevant little movement at the fringes of it all, obsessed with feeble activities like washing people's feet. But then you fast forward to 2025, and all that's left of the Roman Empire is relics in a museum in Glasgow University. The Christian Church, on the other hand, can be found in all the world's continents and in the vast majority of the world's nations. The foot washers won the day, I'm saying. The Christians' basins and towels proved more powerful than the Roman swords and shields. Christ's servants took over the world while Caesar's soldiers floundered and waned and eventually disappeared altogether. Isn't that a marvelous thing? Donald MacLeod, my theology professor, whose gravestone I talked about last Sunday morning, he liked to describe the church in these terms. He would describe it as an invincible army of nobodies. An invincible army of nobodies. The church isn't brash movers and shakers. It's self-abasing nobodies. That's what the Church of Jesus Christ is. And yet, as such, it has proven an invincible army, spreading unstoppably across the planet and outlasting every empire and every regime and every movement. What a marvelous thing. Jesus is right here when he says in the upper room to these 12 men, shaking with fear and trepidation at the thought of conquering the world by washing feet. And he says, you'll be blessed. It's going to work. It's a recipe for success. And we can review that 2,000 years later and say, Jesus was right. Jesus was right. Where's the Roman Empire? Where are the Caesars? Where's every empire of that time and many that have come since and gone since? But Jesus' church, here we are. Here many congregations are in this world tonight. The second thing to notice in these verses is how this works. How this works. How does humble service conquer the world? Well, this is how. Two words: attraction and encounter. Attraction and encounter. So, as the world sees humble service being practiced by Christians, people are attracted to that. Now, of course, not everyone. And Jesus will talk very frankly in this upper room, won't he, about people hating you. So not everyone is attracted by it, for sure. But many people are. There's something deeply winsome about the willingness to stoop low in order to lift others up. And that will be attractive. That will draw people. So that's the attraction aspect. But then there's this second step. As people see then servant-hearted Christians and are drawn to them, they then discover their secret. That they are really only reflecting and representing their servant-hearted master, Jesus. And thus, in these Christians, the world encounters him. This is what Jesus is saying in verse 20. Now, I know I've skipped verses 18 and 19. They are a parenthesis. But verse 20, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me." As the world embraces these beautiful, servant-hearted Christians, it finds it cannot but embrace in the same stroke the beautiful, servant-hearted Jesus. That's the point he's making. And then look at how actually, fascinatingly, the verse continues. And whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. So through the servant-heartedness of Christians, the world sees and embraces the servant-hearted Jesus, and through the servant-heartedness of Jesus, the world then sees and embraces the servant-hearted God. That's what Jesus is saying. Perhaps you've never thought of God in those terms, the servant-hearted God, but that seems to be the logic of what Jesus is saying here. Christians wash feet because Jesus is a foot washer. Jesus washes feet because God is a foot washer. As Donald MacLeod again puts it, the impulse to service lies at the very heart of deity. And oh, may it be the case then that people in Newcastle, people around us, come to meet the servant-hearted God through the servant-hearted Jesus, having first come to meet the servant-hearted Jesus through our servant-heartedness. May that be the chain. They see servant-heartedness in us. They're drawn to that. They encounter the servant-hearted Jesus. And then through him, they encounter the servant-hearted God. Then one last thing to notice. what I called a minute ago the parenthesis. And this is verses 18 and 19, because in verses 18 and 19, Jesus suddenly starts talking about Judas Iscariot. Now, why does he suddenly start talking about him? It seems like a complete non sequitur that doesn't remotely relate to the context and just comes out of nowhere. And to some degree, I think that is the case. And it probably reflects the state of Jesus' mind here. Just like when you're sitting at the dinner table, you have young children and you're sitting at the dinner table and just suddenly out of nowhere, your child mentions some difficult thing that happened in the yard at playtime at school, and it doesn't relate to anything that you've been talking about at the dinner table, but it comes out because it's preying on that child's mind. And I think we have something of that with Jesus here. It's weighing on him dreadfully that he's going to be betrayed by someone close to him. Perhaps we don't think about that enough. We can easily overlook it. It was no small part of Jesus' ordeal that he was going to be betrayed by someone close to him. I mean, betrayal is a horrible thing, isn't it? It's one thing to be mistreated and hurt by a stranger. We can just about cope with that. But to be mistreated and hurt by someone in your own inner circle, that's devastating, that's gut-wrenching. And I'm saying the prospect of it, I think, is getting Jesus down. I mean, he keeps coming back to it, actually, doesn't he, really, throughout this whole passage. It's preying on his mind so that he doesn't need much of an invitation suddenly to bring it up here. And also, of course, he's clearly not just personally devastated about this betrayal that's going to happen. He's also worried, isn't he, as to how that's going to affect the others. I mean, it may cause them to lose confidence in him. After all, Jesus had chosen Judas to be one of the 12. Had Jesus made a terrible error in doing so? You think of how the fall from grace in successive weeks of Angela Rayner and then Peter Mandelson, it caused people to question Keir Starmer's judgment, didn't it? He had chosen these figures. What did that say about him? And the disciples might ask that kind of question. Jesus chose Judas. What does that say about Jesus? And so Jesus is very keen, isn't he, to preempt such questions. I know, verse 18, middle of the verse, I know whom I have chosen. In other words, I've known all along what Judas is. I didn't choose him because I thought he was a great guy. No, I chose him in order that the scriptures would be fulfilled, he says. Verse 19, verse 18, the psalm there, Psalm 41. So, and then verse 19, of course, he adds, I'm telling you this now before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I'm he, so that when you see this betrayal happening, you won't start to question my judgment and lose confidence in me, but you will realize what's going on here. So I'm saying then Jesus, he does kind of say all this about Judas out of the blue, and it's reflecting his state of mind. He's down. It's preying on him that Judas is going to betray him, and he's also worried about how that will affect the others in the group. But having said all that, I think there is a contextual reason too why Jesus suddenly mentions this. Notice in verse 18 then he quotes Psalm 41, doesn't he? Verse 9, he who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. Isn't that an interesting phrase? Lifted his heel. Surely it can't be coincidence that Jesus moves from washing feet to this quote about a heel. Now remember that Judas's feet are amongst those that have just been washed. Verse 12 says, when he had washed their feet, he resumed his place. So he's finished the job, verse 12 is saying. Everyone in that room has had their feet washed, and Judas is in the room. He doesn't leave the room until verse 30. So Judas's feet have been washed. What Jesus done for Peter, Andrew, Thomas, Bartholomew, all of them, he's done it for Judas as well. Jesus has washed Judas's feet, and in a few hours' time then, Judas is going to, as it were, lift his heel and stamp it down viciously on Jesus as he betrays him into the hands of his captors. I think Sinclair Ferguson captures the situation perfectly. He says this. He says, we should never forget that the Lord Jesus was willing to wash the heel that was lifted up to crush him. He was willing to wash the heel that was lifted up to crush him. And I suppose all of this then brings out another dimension to the service that Jesus expects of us, his disciples. He expects us to serve. We've been saying that all along tonight. But he expects us to serve then, not just the people who are relatively easy to serve, but also those who aren't. Those we think don't deserve it. I wonder, are there people in this church whom you would never put yourself out for? Whom you would never perform a lowly, menial task for? Because you bear a grudge against them in relation to something in the past. They've jolly well forfeited their right to be served by you. I'm saying Jesus served Judas. Jesus washed the heel that was about to stamp down on his head. Jesus scraped dirt from underneath the toenails of his betrayer. May we be like him. May we not be discriminating servants. Well, I'll serve him, but I won't serve him. I'll serve her, but I won't serve her. No, may we be like Jesus Christ. May Christ's conduct in the upper room enable us to see the immense dignity of indiscriminate serving. Serving because serving is the right thing and the Christ-like thing. May God help us to be like him. Amen.